All right, there we go. December 14th, Kevin Kosar sitting here with Bill Samuels Jr. of Maker's Mark Distillery. Thank you for making some time for me. I'll shoot through these questions. First one is, I know Maker's Mark has grown over the years, but using a 30-year window, how much has production increased over those 30 years?
Well, when we talk production, we talk production of new whiskey, not bottling. If you use 35 years, that's when I became president of Maker's Mark, and that happens to be a number. From the sales perspective, we were about 65,000 cases. This year we're about 900,000. And one of the concerns that we had when it became apparent that we did have an opportunity to become successful was that we grow at a rate where we could maintain the quality of what we were doing. And that has many, many aspects from continuing to get the grain from the same farm co-ops and making sure that the amount of local water through conservation efforts would allow us to grow. Just because we want to grow, God doesn't give us more water, so we got to conserve, and we didn't want to get in the business of manufacturing limestone water, and just a whole lot of other things. So maintaining the quality standards came first, and we identified that we would manage growth not to exceed 12%. Now, in a recession, that sounds extraordinary, but over these last 35 years, over half of the years, the demand for makers has increased annually at a rate more than 12%. And we stop it at 12%, which is the reason we don't have a lot of international business, because we decided to take care of our domestic customers first. Mm-hmm. So it's grown a lot each year. It doesn't seem like an unbelievable amount, but when you pile up 10 to 11 to 12% every year for 27, 28 straight years, it keeps us hopping.
All right. Was there any one thing that made you decide to grow the brand, or was it a few factors that just came along?
Customers decided. We've never tried to push it on anybody. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, my father was the antithesis. He believed very strongly that you just sat on your thumbs and waited for the mountain to come to Muhammad. And I was able to at least suggest to him that we go out in the marketplace and try to find those people who would most likely be inclined to enjoy a fine bourbon. Mm-hmm. Most of those, by the way, in the 60s and 70s had already decided they didn't like bourbon. Mm-hmm. So it was a pretty much an uphill struggle. But we never pushed. We have always tried to connect with our existing brand fans, and still do today. That's the marketing thrust, if you would call it a marketing thrust. Mm-hmm. Not so much chasing after a demographic, but just connecting with existing brand fans, and hope that they'll take it out and tell their friends. Mm-hmm. As they have. That's where the growth has come from, and I know that because about 99% of all Maker's customers can recall with very specific insight where and when they first learned of Maker's Mark, who introduced it to them, what the situation was. I mean, I'm amazed. Mm-hmm. Chapter and verse. Mm-hmm. And only if the brand were introduced by a friend would that be possible. Mm-hmm. So that's the way we've done it. It's not real sophisticated, but it's very close to the ground.
I say, in terms of gauging customer demand, is there some sort of method, or is it really just a lot of guesswork and tea leaves, and you bump up manufacturing a bit, and then hope your stocks move? Or?
As far as going forward, remember, everything that we will have available for sale over the next six and a half years is already made. Mm-hmm. It's already in the barrels, and we only have one source of supply. The taste profile of Maker's is so different from any other bourbon. We could never buy a product on the open market. Matter of fact, I'm reasonably sure we're the only Kentucky distillery that, has only one source of supply. So forecasting becomes difficult. We do spend a lot of time in church. But I tell you, I watch and listen for the conversation. I don't pay much attention to the dollars. If we do our job right, and which means if we make the product at the distillery that's likely to generate recommendation and trial, then we keep going.
Mm-hmm.
And to give you an example, here we are in the recession, and in the last 2 years, 24 months, well, from January to January, January of 08 to January of 10, the employment at Maker's Mark will have doubled.
Wow.
And the whiskey production will have gone up about 35%. Now, you understand that we don't take production up at 12%. We take it up in steps.
Mm-hmm.
It usually goes up 25 to 35% based on our facility. And then we will run it flat for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we take another jump up.
Okay. Yeah, that anticipates what I was going to ask, whether you're able to manage growth or if it was bursts of growth in production that you had to pull off.
Remember, the other issue with Maker's, because it is more of a delicate bourbon, is that it very quickly gets overaged. So not only does it need to be 6 years in order to have the alcohol and the wood flavors balanced, which means a real tight front palate finish, but it also means after almost 7 1/4 years, that taste profile starts to migrate back in significant ways, and it's no longer Maker's Mark.
Uh-huh.
And that's the extraction of the tannins. They come out over time from deep in the wood, and so we got to get it out of the barrel. So forecasting is a mess. We've got a perishable product. We've only got one source of supply. Everything we've got for the marketplace for the next 6 to 6.5 years is already made. And yet, we've never bought a barrel of whiskey from anybody, and we've never sold a barrel of whiskey because we've overaged it. There's no question, that's my legacy. You know, 35 years running this little business, sometimes having a hard time getting to sleep at night because when the market crashed, what do you know? I don't have any experience at that, and I've been around a long time. So you hope and you listen an awful lot. Best listening place we have about 100,000 of our brand fans come to the distillery every year. I spend every Saturday down there giving tours, just listening to what people are saying about their own situations and what choices they've had to make. I spend a fair amount of time sitting on bar stools. Don't spend too much time in meetings. And it's worked for, you know, worked for 40 plus years, and certainly the last 35 doesn't mean it's going to work tomorrow, because these are pretty upside down times.
Right.
But I got my fingers crossed.
Is there, when you talk, you go through expansion, are there like any one particular logistical or manufacturing challenge that was just an absolute bear, the transportation or the sourcing of the corn, or they're getting it in there? You know, I don't know if there are local ordinances about trucks rumbling through, you know, at higher rates.
Big issues. Dad set up the important stuff first. The water and the grain should come from the same soil if you're going to make a great whiskey. We don't buy from the elevators. Okay, so we had to have really strong relationships with selected farm co-ops that have the same soil composition as we do. And so we nurture and nurse those relationships and have for 50 years. The really difficult part is the water. That's number one. The water source needs to be the natural limestone spring water. We have spent a fortune of separating the water systems, the contact from the non-contact use, of conserving every drop of that natural limestone water. We just spent a couple of $1 million raising the dam so we can collect it all. And then the other thing has to do with going green. And the big piece of that, far and away the big piece, is what do you do with 9/10 of the product that goes through fermentation, it goes through cooking and fermentation. Mm-hmm. What do you do with the stillage? It's a huge waste. It has tremendous food value, and it can chew up an enormous amount of energy if you try to dry it.
Mm-hmm.
So we became the first beverage alcohol industry company in the United States to invest, and it was a shot in the dark with an anaerobic digester, where it's actually a net energy gain. We get about a third from the molecular chewing up of all the foodstuffs.
Mm-hmm.
We generate about a third to 40% of the CO2 gas that we need to run the boilers.
Uh-huh.
So instead of taking energy, mm-hmm. we actually generate energy from it. So the energy equation was zero, but it was difficult because it was the first time it was done. We were the guinea pig for the company that was working with us.
Interesting.
And then what's left over, which is not much, is the fertilizer. You don't have to, it's actually approved as organic fertilizer.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, there'd always been the stories of distillers being able to send off spent grains to hog farmers and that sort of stuff. But when you start talking about a scale, that becomes a little less easy to do. And I would think the transportation cost would be could be jarring unless the hog farming was immediately nearby. I mean, putting that stuff on big trucks and shipping it off to...
It's not so much hogs as it is cattle.
Mm.
In our area, and that's generally the way it still works.
Mm-hmm.
You still got your large feedlots, but the transportation is enormous. And the other issue is that we're a national historic landmark,
right?
And we have trucks down there all day, all night, running up on the grass, tearing it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had all I could take, and that. That goosed us into action, but we really liked the idea of saying, okay, let's get with it. Let's see what we can do, and it cost a lot of money. It cost almost $9 million to do this anaerobic digester. And we have then the other things taking up time now. We have people from all the other companies coming down looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to help them because we think it's a good thing for the whole industry, not just us.
Right, right. That certainly is the drift these days. Green friendly, and why set yourself
up
to be targeted?
As long as it makes economic sense.
Hi there. I'm Helen.
Hi, Helen. How are you?
All right. Foreign markets. Maker's Mark is available overseas, but you said primarily the production is aimed at satisfying domestic consumption?
Well, it was, because we were on and off allocation. So much, and we really didn't have a whole lot of international demand. There's some exceptions, and we would, as we would get some extra supply, we would pick one or two of them, like Japan and the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And then 4 years ago, I asked my son to come into the business, and he asked me two questions. He said, well, what am I going to do? And I said, international development, seed the international markets so the brand can become your life's work, if you come, should be to try to cause the brand to become an international icon as I have caused it to be an American icon.
Mm-hmm.
He said, okay, can I have some supply? And so that forced us to juggle some of the allocations around.
Mm-hmm.
He started the seeding process 4 years ago, and it's gone very well. It's up 300% in 4 years.
Just four years ago that you went into it in earnest?
Yes.
Okay. More broadly, about the bourbon industry, it's obviously changed dramatically over the last 30-some years. I mean, how would you characterize it, and what would you say has driven the change?
Well, I think we've driven an awful lot of it. I think part of it, somebody had to go first. What's happened, the big thing that's happened is now there is what wasn't, which is the association of bourbon and connoisseurship. You go back all the way to when my ancestors came into Kentucky in the early 1780s. That was the farthest thing from, that would be called sissy whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when Makers appeared on the front page of the Wall Street Journal with that very serious recommendation, first time they had ever had a privately held company in that center column of the journal, mm-hmm. back in August of 1980. That, if you said to me, when did people interested in connoisseurship start to take bourbon seriously, that would have been the day.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of Kentucky now, where there's always been some interest in bourbon that tasted good.
Mm-hmm.
And then over the next 8 or 9 years, you know, we started to take advantage of this urban phenomenon. Before that, bourbon was pretty much limited to elderly, white, relatively uneducated Southern gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
Now it was younger, well-educated men and women, mostly in the influence centers in the country.
Mm.
Very different. So that was the new bourbon customer. Probably the new bourbon customer never met an old bourbon customer. So it's like two totally different markets. And it really did start August 1, 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And over these last 30 years, the industry's done a tremendous job of the bourbon industry, of seeing the opportunity that Mom and Dad created, and also offering up their own tremendous versions of craft.
Mm-hmm. It seems everybody has upped their game and expanded their offerings, you know, diversifying, you know, let's try a 4-year, let's try a 7-year, let's try a 12-year, let's personalize bourbon, let's, you know, do this way and other to fully exploit the demand out there. But you have grown despite, without doing that. You don't have a 4-year,
well,
a 7-year, a 9-year. You have the red wax.
We don't bow off exactly on your definition of expanding the craft, because a lot of that is just to keep the buzz going.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, whether it tastes good or not. And you know that. We've got something that works. It's a unique niche. It's the only bourbon that you can hold on your tongue at full strength. And it works pretty well. And there's a whole lot of people out there that haven't experienced the wonderful taste of Makers yet.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not very good marketers, so we just kind of say, well, let's just see where it goes. Plus, we've got overseas. Plus, we've only got so much water.
Right.
We're only good for about 40% more than we're selling now until we're out of water. And we've just got these 4 years internationally, and the demand is growing like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there's a lot of things we could do. One of them is not add wood.
Mm.
Because of the nature of our product, the wood really, it becomes an exercise in chewing on wood chips very quickly after it goes beyond balance, which for us is about 6.5 years.
Mm-hmm. So no plans looking forward to create a rye or to...
No, we've I'm a scientist by education, a physicist. Our master distiller is a biologist, and we spend a fair amount of time together experimenting with what could we do that wouldn't require us to play the game of that total mouthfeel, bitter and sour,
mm-hmm.
and all of that, because and we're not exactly sure how to do it, but we've got some pretty interesting ideas as to think about the Maker's Mark taste profile on steroids.
Hmm.
Okay, that's what we're working on, and that means we have to isolate the tannins.
Mm.
That's not as easy as it sounds, but we're working on it. And if something comes up, good. If it doesn't, it doesn't.
Uh-huh. Otherwise, just keep on growing it bit by bit, up to a 40% cap. Is that the plan?
Yeah, as long as customers prefer bourbon that actually tastes good, we got a pretty good shot.
Okay. All right. Thank you.